Welcome back to the program. When we think about the future and the vast array of dangers that we face as a society and as a species, how big do we think? Is our future measured in days, weeks, hours, or perhaps millennia? For Alvy Singer, the Woody Allen stand-in in Annie Hall, the future was far, far away. Take a listen.
He's been depressed. All of a sudden, he can't do anything.
Why are you depressed, Alvy?
Tell Dr. Flicker. It's something he read.
Something you read, huh?
The universe is expanding.
The universe is expanding?
Well, the universe is everything. And if it's expanding, someday it will break apart and that will be the end of everything.
What is that your business? He stopped doing his homework.
What's the point?
What has the universe got to do with it? You're here in Brooklyn. Brooklyn is not expanding.
It won't be expanding for billions of years yet, Alvy. We've got to try and enjoy ourselves while we're here, huh? Huh?
The fact is that Alvy was thinking in species time. And history tells us that species do go extinct, that our day will come, and maybe it's something we should be thinking about. My guest, Annalee Newitz, has certainly been thinking about it, and she lays it out in her new book, Scatter, Adapt, and Remember. Annalee Newitz is the founding editor of the science website io9.com. She's a journalist with decades' experience in writing about science, culture, and the future, and it is my pleasure to welcome her here today to talk about Scatter, Adapt, and Remember, how humans will survive a mass extinction. Annalee Newitz, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Delight to have you here. For most of us, I suppose, thinking about the future means thinking about what's happening next week or next month if we're really adventurous, not thinking about it in terms of these grand arcs of time. Talk a little bit about that.
It's true. I think, you know, most of us are really worried about what we're going to have for lunch. And one of the things that I was looking at in this book are these huge arcs of time during which events called mass extinctions take place. And these are the most devastating disasters that can happen to the planet. And it's when more than 75% of all species die out in about a million years. So it's a long period of time. It's a slow disaster. And a lot of scientists now are worried that we may be headed into a new one. And so it's upon us as humans living in this time to start thinking in these really long million-year time spans, and it's hard to do, and it's a sort of a new skill that I'm hoping that my book can help people think about.
You talk about 75% of species going extinct as this kind of magic number, but in fact, one of the other things you talk about is that it only takes 35-40% of species going extinct before it starts this irreversible downward spiral.
Yeah, that's right. There is evidence that it's not, when you look at a mass extinction, it's not like one species, two species, three species, and it's kind of in a neat little pattern, because most species depend on each other for food or for other kinds of energy and sustenance. So if one or two species dies out, that may cause a knock-on extinction of two or three more species. And so it looks like from some simulations that scientists have run that once you have about 40% of species go extinct, then you suddenly have a huge upward tick in the number of other knock-on species going extinct. And usually it's as simple as, you know, those 40% of species are things like grasses that animals eat or coral reefs where lots of animals get food. And so once you have these really basic food-type species going extinct, then you're going to see a ton of other species go extinct.
One of the things that is so powerful about this is the idea that whether we like it or not, history tells us that these cycles simply continue to happen. And historically, they've happened with some regularity.
That's right. There have been 5 mass extinctions already in the past half billion years on Earth. And to give you some perspective, Earth is 4.5 billion years old. So in the recent period, there have been 5 of these. And they are pretty regular. And oftentimes they're caused by some kind of disaster, like a huge volcanic eruption that lasts for many centuries, or an asteroid hits the planet, which is what happened in the most recent mass extinction that wiped out the dinosaurs 65 million years ago. But usually the reason why these are kind of slow motion disasters that take hundreds of thousands of years is that you have a disaster, and that disaster sets off climate change over time. It changes habitats. It puts more carbon into the environment, especially in the case of a big volcano. And so what we see over the planet's many, many million year life cycles are what we call a carbon cycle. There's more carbon in the environment, things heat up, the climate changes, and this happens many times throughout the planet's history, and it is often associated with these big extinction events.
And none of these things happen in a vacuum, and talking about climate is a good example, where these carbon cycles you talk about exist regardless, but in fact, what we do and how we deal with it may in fact influence it as well.
That's right. It is true that throughout the planet's history, as far as we know, there have been these carbon cycles, and there has been really catastrophic climate change. There have been greenhouse phases in the planet before, in the planet's history before. But yeah, it's very likely that what humans are doing today is affecting, or as scientists like to say, perturbing the carbon cycle. And what that means is just that, like a mega volcano, we've had an industrial revolution. We've pumped a lot of carbon into the atmosphere. And it's a simple chemical reaction. It causes things to heat up. And when things heat up, habitats change, and that makes it difficult for animals and plants to continue living in the places that they have lived. And that's when extinctions start happening. So we also have technologies now, and we have the knowledge now to realize that this is going on. And so it's my hope that we can actually start to reverse these trends and mitigate some of the damages that have been done from this the beginning phase of this mass extinction.
One of the interesting ideas that you talk about is this notion that there are multiple evolutionary cycles going on at the same time, just as we as a species are evolving, as we have for some 200,000 plus years. Everything around us is also in a state of evolution, but all at different points.
Well, absolutely, because humans exist within an ecosystem. And so all of the plants and animals around us are evolving at the same time that we are. And of course, we're evolving at a rate that isn't something that you can sense in sort of one lifetime. So we live, you know, all humans live at this kind of bizarrely accelerated pace, say 80 years or 90 years, and you can't see these changes going on. You can only really see them by stepping back and looking at the world around you through the lens of science and seeing, oh, these animals and plants around me are all the result of lots of years of evolution, and they're just in the middle of the journey. You know, we have many, many hundreds of thousands of years of evolution ahead of us, especially in the case of humans. We're very early in our species lifespan. A typical mammal evolves for about a million years before either going extinct or evolving into another species. Humans only evolved 200,000 years ago. That means we have about 800,000 years left of evolution. So we really do have some time to figure out what to do with it and to make an environment that's healthy for us and for all of the other creatures in our ecosystem.
As we look at computer models, for example, of some of these past mass extinctions, what do we learn from that, and what can it tell us going forward?
Yeah, that's a great question. One of the ways that we look at extinctions is using computer models, because usually you have so many life forms involved that you really do need a computer to help you understand all the relationships between those life forms in an ecosystem. And those relationships are described as a food web. So in every environment, there's a web of relationships between animals and plants where, you know, some creatures are eaten, some creatures eat other creatures, and then there's things like grass that kind of get eaten by everybody. And what happens as you have extinction events taking place is, in a computer model, we can sort of show how pulling parts out of that food web, so say starting with pulling out a grass or pulling out coral, you can see how many other life forms will go extinct because they depend on that one little node in the food web. And that gets back to that 40% number we were talking earlier, because if you take 40% of the nodes out of that food web. And remember, those nodes are like animals or plants or even insects. The more you pull those out, the fewer other life forms are able to survive. And so you have to imagine a kind of, at the height of a mass extinction, your food web is in tatters. And what these computer simulations allow us to look at is how quickly that can happen, whether certain types of die-offs create bigger mass extinctions than others, and also how long it takes to recover. Because, of course, once you've reached the height of that mass extinction, how long before you have stable food webs again? And that can also be a matter of hundreds of thousands of years or millions of years.
Talk a little bit about those things that are going extinct now, the species that have gone extinct that may have an influence on this broader framework we're talking about.
So right now, there's a lot of evidence that we're seeing an elevated extinction rate, which just means that, you know, there's a typical number of species we expect to see going extinct just naturally. That's just how evolution works. But right now, at least over the past 200 years or so, when we've actually kept very good records, we're seeing a much higher rate than normal. And we know what a normal rate is from looking at the fossil record and seeing what, you know, a typical time is for species to be around before they go extinct. So what we're seeing is we're seeing elevated extinctions among birds. We're seeing die-offs in the ocean among creatures like corals that are associated with coral reefs because of acidification, which is, again, because of carbon in the environment. And that's a very important area of die-off because, again, coral reefs are a huge food web. So you see die-offs there, and you're going to get a lot of knock-ons. There's also been elevated die-offs among birds, and we suspect among other animals as well. And, of course, when you're looking at a mass extinction, remember, it's these thousands of years and hundreds of thousands of years. So a lot of scientists trace the beginning of the current crisis back to the die-offs that happened 15,000 years ago when things like woolly mammoths and saber-toothed cats went extinct, and that may be kind of the beginning phase of this extinction cycle that we're in, because, of course, there were all of these amazing what we call megafauna, which just means big animals, all of which died out in the Americas, almost all of which died out.
And, of course, today we have the power to bring these things on ourselves with things like nuclear weapons and who knows what else in terms of creating our own kind of mass extinction.
Yes, certainly nuclear weapons would be one way. But actually, as I was saying earlier, climate change, to the extent that we are helping climate change to happen right now, to the extent that we're warming the planet up, I mean, that is a very efficient way of causing a mass extinction. That's how most of them have been caused historically. So even if we had some kind of horrific atomic war, in the end, what would probably kill most of the species wouldn't be the actual bombs, but the subsequent nuclear winter and then the global warming that would happen after that, which would destroy food webs. So you would have kind of an immediate, horrible bunch of fire, and then over time you would have terrible climate change that would really seal the deal, as it were.
Today, everybody thinks that science will somehow save us, that human ingenuity will prevent these natural things from happening.
I think it's very possible that it will. There's a lot of work being done right now on alternative fuels that don't pollute the environment with carbon, which means that we would be mitigating the damages caused by putting more carbon into the environment. There's also, in a more far future time frame, people thinking about geoengineering technologies, which are technologies we could use to take control of the way that we're changing the atmosphere. Because, of course, we're already changing the climate and changing the atmosphere with our burning fossil fuels and releasing all kinds of other chemicals into the environment. So why not take charge of that and create machines or technologies that actually help us change the environment to remain the way we would like it, to remain cooler, to keep the ice caps on the poles, to maintain the ocean without the level of acidification that it's experiencing right now. So these are all hopeful technologies, especially in the near term, things like solar technology. The question is, how quickly can we do it and how much damage has already been done? And that's something we just don't know. But we do have time, definitely have time to mitigate the damage and to prevent a mass extinction.
We think that everything is going to move forward scientifically at the same rate that it has moved forward, for example, in the computer age. And that may be the anomaly. In fact, science doesn't always move that fast.
It's true. There's definitely that feeling that because we, you know, went from having no computers at all in the early 20th century to having the internet now, that we're just going to, you know, march forward, and in 40 years we're going to have solved all this stuff, and we'll have big giant machines at the poles making ice, and we'll be extinct saber-toothed cats, and it'll just be awesome, right? I don't think that that's I think that's unrealistic. One of the issues that I really emphasize in my book is that we need to have realistic expectations about the time frame for a lot of these technologies, and we need to be tackling projects in the near term that are within our grasp. And that's why I mentioned solar, and I think solar energy as an alternative to fossil fuel energy, that's actually a technology that is maturing right now and that we can be looking at making even more efficient, making it into technology that doesn't produce any waste, and really that can be something we do immediately. But stuff like geoengineering, which to some people even sounds kind of so far in the future that it's pie in the sky, you know, I think that that will happen, but it may be centuries before we have something like that. So that's something we can be researching, but in the immediate present term, we really need to focus on stuff that's already viable. And so it's important to kind of keep that perspective and realize that there's a pathway that we want to be on, which is moving toward the future of really being able to take responsibility for the planet, but we also should be focusing on stuff that we can do now as well.
In terms of putting it into a broader time frame, you use the analogy of boats, for example. When boats existed versus when they became really viable.
That's right. One of the arguments I make in the book is that ultimately, over hundreds of thousands of years, that humans really need to be thinking about going on to other planets or moving into space, for a lot of reasons, not just to preserve the Earth, but also because humans are explorers, and it's inevitable that we're going to want to do that and that we're going to need to have other kinds of places to live because the planet is dangerous. You know, it gets hit by space rocks. There's big volcanoes. We need to keep moving. But the question is, how fast will that happen? And there's a lot of pop culture that suggests that we're going to be living on Mars in like 20 years. And maybe a few of us will be. Certainly we have a robot on Mars now. But really, when we think about space flight, we do need to think about the history of boats on Earth, which is what you mentioned. Humans first invented boats that allowed them to cross the ocean 50,000 years ago. So people took boats from Asia to Australia 50,000 years ago, and they were just these reed boats, you know, made from grasses that had been lashed together. And they also took boats to, it looks like now, they took boats from Asia to the Americas as well, about, you know, 15 or 20,000 years ago. And so we had the technology tens of thousands of years ago to cross the ocean in boats, but it wasn't until about 500 years ago that we had a real intercontinental culture where we could actually base our societies and our economies on crossing the ocean on a regular basis. And so I think that that's a useful kind of story about how technology develops when we think about space travel, because I think right now with our rocket ships, we're kind of at that phase where humans were leaving Asia for Australia. We can get out into space, we can land on the moon, we can land on Mars, but can we really have an interplanetary culture yet? I think that's at least thousands of years away. Hopefully not 50,000 years away. That would be really depressing. I hope it'll be sooner than that, but I don't think it'll be next century. I think we're looking at a much longer time frame to be really seeing, you know, a Star Trek-type future, which I hope we get to at some point. I think that would be a great pathway for humans.
Which brings us back to where we started as to why we should be thinking about these issues today, because, to use the popular vernacular, the lead time is so long.
It is long. And as I was saying earlier, you know, humans, as mammals, you know, we have a species lifespan that's likely to be about a million years. During that time, we're going to be changing a lot. And the reason why we need to be thinking about that is we want our species to survive. And in order to survive, we need our environment to survive. Because, of course, we're part of the food web. We depend on the planet's environment for food and sustenance of all kinds. And so we need to be thinking about these long-term carbon cycles and thinking, all right, you know, in my individual lifetime, I'm not really going to see a tremendous amount of transformation in the environment from climate change. It's only from looking in this really long-term species time or geological time using science and using history that we can actually see, oh, wow, we are really changing things. The planet is changing. We need to figure out ways to intervene so that our progeny and our hopefully offspring living thousands of years from now will have a planet to enjoy. And I think even if they don't enjoy the planet, humans will be around. That's kind of the dark side of this story, is that I think humans have many of the traits of species that have survived previous mass extinctions. But that kind of survival can be really ugly and really horrible and full of famine and disease. And what I really hope that people can do is think about how we can survive in a way that isn't worse than death, so that we're not having to survive through a mass extinction, but that we can use our social skills and our technologies to actually prevent a mass extinction from happening and prevent the planet from having to go through one of these really horrific periods. So we have to have the long-term view in order to do that, because we're never going to be able to, in one generation, make enough changes to prevent the carbon cycle from getting really out of whack.
Annalee Newitt, her book is Scatter, Adapt, and Remember, How Humans Will Survive a Mass Extinction. It's just out from Doubleday. Annalee, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Thank you. We'll take a break. I'll be right back.